the beginning of each year, I'd like to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. So I'd like that to be the topic of today. Some years ago, there was a scholar who tried to argue that the Four Noble Truths, kind of went back into the early texts of Buddhism and did kind of a careful textual study of the words and the passages and where the Four Noble Truths occurs in the early discourses of the Buddha, and came to the conclusion that the Four Noble Truths arose in Buddhism after the time of the Buddha. The Buddha didn't teach them. The person who told me about this was Tanisra Bhikkhu, Tanjef, who teaches here sometimes for us. And he'd read the book, and he thought the argument was based on very bad assumptions. But he said, it doesn't really matter. Whoever came up with the Four Noble Truths, that's my Buddha. So the Four Noble Truths are seen as the very central to the Buddhist tradition. And some people have said that all of Buddhism can somehow or other be fit inside the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are often seen as the essential teachings of Buddhism. But in calling them teachings, it might be a little bit misleading. And also to call them truths. Because especially a Western audience will often hear that or read that as being tenets or beliefs. These are the four cardinal beliefs that Buddhists are supposed to believe in. I don't think they're being offered as beliefs, as they are being offered as something very practical, as experiences and explorations of ways of understanding our life, and something that can be verified very directly, maybe even immediately in our own experience, as opposed to something we have to believe, some tenet or some assumption that's apart from your experience. The Four Noble Truths, just to state them before I go into them, are the truth of dukkha, and tentatively we'll call dukkha suffering, but it's a kind of an inadequate translation, the truth of suffering. The second is the truth of the arising of that dukkha, of suffering. The third is the truth of the cessation of that suffering. And the fourth is the path to accomplish that cessation, to bring it to an end. It's said that when a person really understands the Four Noble Truths well, they understand all four altogether. So some of us can understand suffering really well, but you don't really understand the noble truth of suffering unless you can some way or other understand all four together. They make a system. They work at make an ecology of the mind or the heart. They're integral to each other, the Four Noble Truths. And so what is the kind of vision or understanding that helps us to see all four at the same time? And that is very important to keep in mind. One perhaps simple analogy would be if you made a really hard fist with your hand, really hard so it hurt. And then after a while you're aware that it really hurts. But probably if you did that, you realize at the same time as seeing that it hurts to hold a tight fist, you realize that it's possible to end that tight. The hurt pain is coming from the way you're holding yourself. It's possible to end that pain by releasing it. And, you know, it's kind of obvious you can do that. You know, just the truth of suffering there, the pain there, and the truth of the possibility of release are seen together at the same time. And then you have to decide whether you're going to release it or not. Because it's said the Four Noble Truths are to be seen altogether, can be seen altogether, maybe it doesn't really matter where we begin when we start talking about them. Usually in talks about the Four Noble Truths, people begin by talking about the first one, about suffering. And there's some logic to that. But I would like to start today with a third one, with the idea that maybe it's a little bit arbitrary where you begin. The third one is called Nirodha in Pali. It's translated as cessation or the ending or seizing of something. And all of the whole world of realization, of enlightenment, of liberation, of freedom from suffering, of relief, of release, that's possible, is kind of subsumed under this third noble truth of what's called cessation. It doesn't only imply the ending of something, though that's literally what it says, the ending of suffering. It also implies a whole realm of entering into a whole realm, maybe a dimension of the heart or the mind, which Buddhists would like to sometimes call sacred or spiritual, or has to do with human perfection or purity or beauty, well-being, dimension of the psyche that is quite wonderful and phenomenal. And most people, I think, have had some experience in their life, maybe as a child, maybe as a young adult, maybe as an older person, doesn't matter. Some experience in their life that of unusual well-being. Some sense of well-being is unusual from the point of view of what you normally experience in day-to-day experience. Remember when I first started meditating, I remembered it was kind of like the meditations, the calm, the subtleness of meditation, kind of brought back memories I'd long forgotten. And it happens to many people. And sometimes they're unpleasant memories, and sometimes they're pleasant ones, and I had both. But I remember some of the pleasant ones that I had, and one of them was, I remembered when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I was living in Italy, and I took the public bus to school every day, to my Italian school. And on the way home, on the school bus, on the bus home, well, they had a system where they had a driver, and they had I think what they called a conductor, the person who sold your tickets. And he'd sell your tickets, and he had different tickets for different categories, round trip, children, one way, I don't know, there's all these little, he had a packet of different kinds of tickets. And I lived near the end of the bus line, two or three maybe stops before the end. And so as we got to the end, the conductor would sit down in one of the little single seats, and near the front of the bus, and he would tally up the tickets that he had, the different ones he'd sold. It had numbers on them, I guess. And then he had this tally sheet, and he'd write down what he'd sold, the different kind of tickets. So he kept record each time. I started making a habit of always trying to sit on the single seat kind of behind where he would sit to do the tallying. Because when I watched him do his tallying, I kind of was pulled, had no idea what was going on, but I was pulled into a world of phenomenal well-being, kind of very global, kind of warmth. And nowadays, I understand that I was becoming concentrated. Somehow he was concentrated, I guess, or I don't know if I was borrowing his concentration, or just he was focused on something, and somehow I kind of, it was like a wave that I got to ride. And it was like kind of being pulled on this wave into some kind of state of concentrated well-being. And when I started meditating, some 10, 11 years after that, more than that, 14, I guess, I started having this memory. Then that memory became a reference point for me for what was possible in meditation, what was possible. A reference point for a certain kind of level of well-being. Having that reference point gave me a better understanding of what I could do in meditation, and what I could do with my mind, my heart, of what's possible, how to live a human life. So that was a reference point. To the degree to which we've had some well-being, some experience of peace or calm or inner beauty or feeling of inner harmony, or, you know, there's a lot of different words. That's a little bit unusual, a little bit different than a normal way in which we live. That sense of well-being can be a reference for what is possible. And having that as a reference of what's possible, then the question is, how can I make this more part of my life? How can I use this to inform my life so that I can move in that kind of direction with my life? Is it reasonable? Is it something that we want to do? I know sometimes I've had experiences of well-being in my life when I was earlier in my life that I didn't really, like when I was, you know, I didn't really take seriously. Oh, that was nice for what it was, but I didn't really see it as a possibility for what I could live in or be like most of the time or kind of touch into more often. I felt that somehow it was an accident, or it was, you know, just a fluke, you know, who knows what it was. Or maybe it came from certain experiences, certain situations that I didn't want to repeat. I didn't want to go back into those kinds of experiences again. the time I felt this tremendous clarity and openness and warmth for having an experience that put me, if I'd gone, you know, a foot further sliding down the hill, I would have gone over that cliff. And, you know, that cliff was really, you know, and it was really foggy, so I didn't know that there was even a cliff there until I stood up. So when I realized that, you know, I don't want to repeat that experience as a way of feeling some kind of special aliveness and really present, and here I am. Some people have car accidents or near car accidents, and just kind of wakes them up really quickly, get really clear. So we don't have to kind of look for the car accidents again, but that clarity that can happen, tremendous clarity or a sense of presence that can happen in different kinds of circumstances, can become a reference point for what is possible to do with the human mind. One of the teachings of Buddhism is the human heart or the mind is quite malleable. It's kind of like software. And the software can be changed. You can change the operating system. And the mind is not hardware. So because of software, it's quite malleable. If the mind was hardware, maybe you couldn't change it much. But the mind is software. So the third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the Buddha said, is something to be penetrated. It's not something to be believed in. It's not a belief system, but it's something to be realized or penetrated or touched. And so the question is not, you know, what the Buddha said in some ultimate way, but the Four Noble Truths have immediate practical benefit moment by moment in our life. So to penetrate or to realize the cessation of suffering can mean even a simple way to realize that I don't have to be uncomfortable or I don't have to get caught up in being embarrassed. Situation you come into and you're embarrassed. I came here and sat down and realized my zipper was down when I sat down in front of all of you. That's very embarrassing, even more embarrassing to tell you. But, you know, I didn't suffer too much because of it. You know, if I suffered a lot, I probably wouldn't tell you. So you know, I had a choice there. You know, do I get caught up in the inner world of embarrassment and self-identity and how you see me and all that stuff? And I could have suffered and gotten very contracted, very tight, and very self-conscious around this one thing. But basically, I chose not to. A little bit, you know, but I couldn't get away from. So it's, you know, very simple, immediate. You know, I see the possibility. I came here, in a sense, in a situation where there was a sense of well-being. My sense of well-being was not that dramatic. I have a teeny bit of a cold. But my sense of well-being was better than what would have happened if I got caught up in my embarrassment. So I took seriously the sense of well-being I had as a reference point for my embarrassment. Often what happens in life, we forget. We get caught up, preoccupied in what's going on, and we think this is it. This is how it's going to be always. Maybe we logically think we're not going to say that, but it's kind of like how I operate. This is kind of caught up in the drama of this particular event right now. There's a very healthy way of using reference points to help us then to find the path, to find what's possible. There's unhealthy ways of using a reference point. If you beat yourself up or self-critical for, you know, I used to feel better and now I feel worse, I must be a bad person, or it's really important that I feel better. There's all kinds of ways in which we can kind of get caught up in the world of comparisons. But the world of contrast can be very helpful. As a person does, hopefully, any kind of spiritual practice, but certainly like a meditation practice, or it could be other things. It could be spending a week in the Sierras hiking, or many things that can kind of change the context of our psyche, change the way we are, let go of a lot of surface kind of preoccupations of the mind, and help us to settle into a deeper sense of well-being. The deeper that well-being is, the more powerful the reference point is for what's possible when we leave that sense of well-being. So part of the function of meditation practice is to help us go as deeply as we can to realize a quality or possibilities of well-being that are not available in daily life. The unusual thing about most people's daily minds is that well-being is relative. So if you're the Buddha gave this analogy, I don't know if this works exactly, but it comes to mind. Apparently in ancient India, people who had leprosy, which causes you to itch and feel really bad on your skin, they would put their hand or their body into fire, because fire somehow cauterized, I don't know what it did, but it somehow made it feel better. It was a relief compared to what they were feeling. But then once they were somehow cured of the leprosy, the Buddha said, then the last thing they want to do is put their arm into the fire, because that would be really painful. So in the relationship to the tremendous pain, I guess, of leprosy, the fire was a relief. But in relationship to a normal arm, it's not a relief. So in a normal life, if you're really anxious about, you know, any kind of normal thing, you're really anxious about, I don't know, choose something.
Meditating.
You're really anxious about meditating. Why are you anxious about meditating?
Not.
Oh, you're not. Just use something.
It's just
a smog check for your car. Anxious about a smog check for your car. So, you know, so finally you figure out how to do it, or you send a friend to do it for you who knows how to get these things done. And, you know, and it passes. And then you hear that it passes, and you feel a relief, and you feel a sense of well-being, and that level of anxiety is gone. And you feel kind of good. But that level of being feeling good is only relative, because in that state of good, you can actually be better. The degree to which the mind is preoccupied or caught up or contracted is often invisible to the mind. A mind that's distracted is often so distracted it doesn't even know it's distracted. So what I'm trying to say here is that the normal everyday consciousness people walk around in has levels of discomfort or dis-ease or suffering or contractions or tightness or that often isn't invisible. That often is invisible as we just go around preoccupied with our life. But once we kind of can settle deeper and deeper and deeper and let go perhaps, get more calm, deeper calm, then we see there's possibilities of well-being that are much greater than what we even think is possible when we walk around the streets of Redwood City. Making my point okay? So part of the function of something like a meditation practice is to show us a possibility. Now, some people will go on retreat and experience perhaps a kind of possibility. And then I know it's pretty common for people to feel really bad as they leave when they leave the retreat and the normal mind comes back. Oh, I had it. And I'm really a bad person because now I don't have it. Or there's many, many situations where we have something very profound and then we lose it and we feel kind of somehow we suffer because we've lost it. That's what kind of meditation suffering. You know, we had something great in meditation once, and then we haven't had it for a whole year ever since. And this is, you know, a sign of personal failing or something terrible. But one of the ways to use, one of the ways to practice with the third noble truth is to appreciate the memory of something, the possibility of something, and then in that memory or in that understanding of it, then begin to search for the path. What is it that I have to work with? What is it that I have to work with in order to, you know, what is it that this is highlighting that shows me where my work is? And to understand where the work is one of the crucial things in Buddhist practice. Where is my work? What work is it that I have to do here? If it's only about kind of going on a beautiful linear line from your suffering to great infinite happiness, you just go on a slide, you know, you know. It would be great, right? But it doesn't really work that way. Some people have had that experience through drugs. And a lot of people in the 60s came to Buddhism through LSD. And they had kind of, some of them had good trips, some had bad trips. But, you know, this wonderful slide effect, it's just, it was easy. Most of the people who survived that in a mature way stopped taking the drugs and realized they had work to do. The drugs showed them a possibility, and now they had to get down to work. And they had to kind of work on themselves, take responsibility for what's going on here. And so that the greater the contrast, the more it gives us a chance to understand where the work is, what we have to address and work with, where the path is. We're beginning to find the path, looking for the path. So, the fourth noble truth is a truth of the path. The truth of the path begins with what's called seeing the path, having the right view, finding the path. So how do you find the path? You know you have this possibility of well-being. You've tasted it perhaps to some degree, little or big. You know it's possible. You know you're not having it now, so you see a contrast. And you know, so you know it's possible to be different, but you don't know quite how. So you see the possibility, but you don't know how. So the Buddha said there's a path. And the path begins by finding the path. So you have to find the path. So the question is, where do I find the path? Where do I look here? One of the very remarkable things about what the Buddha taught is that he took the simplest route, the simplest formulation to find that path. There can be complex mazes to be created that you can kind of maybe find the path, but it's so complicated and maze-like. Or you can find one that's relatively easy to find, straightforward. And my father is a scientist, and one of the things he loves about science is when you figure out a new equation, and it's really simple and beautiful. Simplicity is beauty. So E equals MC squared, right? An amazing discovery, but it's so beautiful and simple, elegant. My father likes the word elegant. That was a really elegant solution. So I think the Four Noble Truths is a really simple, beautiful, and elegant solution to the human problem. It's very profound, but it can appear on the surface to be kind of simplistic or trite or not very deep or ultimate compared to what other religions might have. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the path. I mean, where's you know, some people have, you know, union with God. You know, that's like pretty hot. And Buddhists just have the suffering. The cause of suffering. And, you know. So, you know. But I think it's like it has this elegance. It's really simple. In its simplicity, it's very profound. So the beginning of the path, the first step in the path, is finding the path. Finding the path, the elegant solution for finding the path the Buddha offered, was to look at our life through the framework of the Four Noble Truths. To look at our life through that perspective. So, not look at it, for example, through union with Brahma, the great God. Not look at it through union with oneness with nature. Not look at it through finding the true self. There's a lot of kind of wonderful things spiritual people do that are kind of metaphysical searches that have a lot of difficulty in the search and what we find, how we relate to it. So the Buddha wanted to avoid any kind of metaphysical quagmire, he called it, and offer something that was free of that maze that we get into and you never get out of, perhaps. So the Four Noble Truths is that. The Four Noble Truths is not a belief. The whole foundation of Buddhism is not based on a belief of any kind, I would say, I would argue, but rather on something we can experience and feel. How many of you know when you're suffering? Only some of you, apparently. The rest of you are kind of in remedial Buddhism, cool. Well, some of you don't, you know, we can know suffering, and also sometimes we don't know the degree to which we suffer. And so there are levels of suffering we don't even know we have until the mind gets really still and concentrated. So it begins with something we can experience. suffering. So the first noble truth, how we find the path, is beginning to appreciate when there is suffering. Or this word dukkha. Suffering is kind of a big word. Dukkha, the word dukkha is sometimes translated into English as stress, sometimes as unsatisfactoriness, sometimes as unease, sometimes as, you know, what else? What other choices have I heard? What? Well, thirst is the second one, is the second noble truth, is the cause of that dukkha. And the word suffering maybe is inadequate because it suggests that suffering is kind of a big word. But even mild discomfort, mild annoyance is dukkha. And but the point is here is that you find the path by beginning to appreciate the discomfort or the disease or the dukkha that is present. So you realize what you're working with. You see the possibility, perhaps, of freedom. You see the possibility of well-being, of calm or peace. You know you don't have it. You don't have much of it. You see that's possible. The work to getting there is not to do a spiritual bypass around your life, around your difficulties, which some people would like to do, but rather the path is through our life, as it actually is, through the life of our discomfort. What is my suffering here? To really understand it and see it clearly. We're uncomfortable, we're suffering because we have to get the smog check. What is that about? Where's the work? Where's the path to be found there? Where's the spiritual path to be found in that particular phenomena? Do we blame the DMV? Blaming the DMV is not where the work is found. It's counterproductive, even if the DMV is responsible. Even when someone's responsible somehow for the condition of your suffering, it's not where the spiritual work resides. It doesn't reside in out there. It always resides in here, the spiritual work. Where is it in here that I contribute or that I'm suffering and I contribute to that suffering? So the Buddha said that the duty or the responsibility in relationship to the first noble truth of suffering is to understand it really well. That's the kind of, you know, the bad news of Buddhism. Because we'd like to have something that inspires us, lifts us up, makes us feel better. And here you're told you've got to understand your suffering. That's where it all begins. But it's much more understandable when you get the good news first. Right? That's what I did today. To start with the third noble truth. There is this wonderful thing that's possible. The thing is that in order to approach that freedom in a healthy way, you need to look at your suffering and understand it. As you understand it, part of that understanding is to understand the cause of it. What is it that gives rise to it? And there's a wide range of things. Sometimes you'll see it's obvious what gives rise to it. It's really simple and easy. And other times, it's very complicated and very difficult to see the cause of our suffering. So the cause that Buddha gave is what you said. He defined it as thirst. And thirst is not a technical, psychological, or spiritual word. It's just kind of like a colloquial expression, thirst. So part of that meaning is that it's evocative because it evokes, I think for me at least, evokes a kind of feeling of being driven or compulsive feeling. When you're really thirsty, there's kind of a feeling of compulsion. I need water. You have to be really thirsty, right? You're in the desert. And we have these expressions in English like thirsting for power or other words like that, right? Thirsting, kind of unhealthy kind of movements. Thirsting for power, thirsting for money, thirsting for, I don't know. And so, you know, it's kind of the feeling you're not really a free person when you have that kind of compulsive activity of the mind or the heart. Or, you know, we're driven. Drivenness is maybe a good modern equivalent to thirst. Because we say a lot of people are driven. When you're driven, you're not free. So underneath the umbrella of this word thirst or drivenness is things like clinging, craving, grasping, resisting, denying, all this moving, kind of pushing away or holding on to, running away. all these ways in which the mind somehow or other, or the heart somehow or other, contracts onto itself, tightens up for what Buddhism calls suffering. Sometimes it can feel more mental, like sometimes you feel a contraction in your brain and your mind, feels a suffering there. Sometimes it's more in the heart, in the emotional body, sometimes in the physical body where we feel it. Wide varieties of places where it might manifest the discomfort that we're feeling, that the kind of discomfort that arises from the fact that we are resisting, reacting in a way that is tightening down, or holding out, or freezing, or something. So the second noble truth is the truth of what gives rise to this discomfort, this dukkha, this drivenness. And the responsibility or the activity to be done in relationship to it is not again to believe this. The activity in relationship to it is to let go of it, to abandon the cause. If there is clinging, to abandon it, to let go of it. Now it's very important to understand the Four Noble Truths are relevant in the simplest situations of our life as well as the most profound, so that we begin practicing them or working on this on the simple everyday kind of things of our life. Things that places where it's really easy to see, oh, I'm suffering, I can see the cause, I can let go of that cause. So, you know, I'm convinced that every one of you has some place really easy where you can do that. Do it. Start exercising that muscle in the simplest places. It's like going to the gym. And, you know, I go to the gym sometimes, and we have, probably all you guys know this, but you know, there's all these rectangular weights, they're all stacked up, and you can like put this pin into the, you know, into the weight that you want. And so like if I put the pin in the 5-pound weight, you know, it doesn't really do much for me. Maybe if I just spend a couple hours, it eventually would have some meaning. But that 5-pound weight doesn't do anything. But I have to go down there like to the 8 or the 9 pounds sometimes, you know, get a little bit further. And then I can feel a workout. But if I go down there and put it in like 20 or 50 or something, you know, then it's hopeless also. You have to have just the right one, right? And then, but you don't want too much, not too little. You have to kind of pace yourself just right. And you work there and exercise that muscle and kind of, you know, get stronger and stronger. And then eventually you can kind of move it down and do more weight and then more weight and more weight and then more weight. And then, you know, more weight until finally, you know, you realize that you can't go any further. So the mind or the heart, spiritual life, is the same way. Some people try to jump in too fast, too deep, too fast. They think, oh, I'm supposed to realize the true nature of the self in this sitting. You know, I'm supposed to resolve all my complex karmic difficulties right now. Thank you. This retreat. And sometimes that's like too big of a weight to take on. But if you just work at the place that's appropriate for you, and if you take it seriously in the simplicity of places, simple places of your life, you're exercising that muscle. And as you exercise, it gets stronger. And as you develop this capacity, this skill to look at suffering, to find its cause, and to let go of it, that will be useful as you get at situations where bigger and bigger things, where you face bigger and bigger things, heavier and heavier weights. I know some people only get interested in something like Buddhism when there's some great crisis in their life. And they will come to a teacher, for example, and say, well, what do I do now? Well, you can give people advice. But if they've been building that muscle for the few years before that crisis, they might have had the skills and the ability to understand what was going on that they don't have because they weren't practicing all along. Don't wait until a crisis. Start now when you can. And build the self-understanding, the skills you need, the ability to see. So there's the truth of cessation. There's a truth of letting go. There's truth of letting go of clinging, and the well-being that can come from that. that gives us a sense of what's possible. Because we've tasted it. Even if it's just a little bit. If we want to taste it more, then do something like a meditation practice. Or live, do those kind of things that allows you to step into that world a little bit greater, more often. Don't live your life on automatic pilot where you can continue living a life of suffering, a life of being preoccupied or caught up, that precludes the possibility of well-being. Well-being is essential to Buddha spiritual life. Avail yourself of your capacity to feel well-being to the degree to which you can. I think a lot of people shortchange themselves because they feel like other things are more important. So as you get a sense of your well-being, then you can see the contrast of that at times when you don't have that well-being. And in that contrast, there you can start finding the path. And the Buddha said the most elegant or the simplest, most direct way of finding the path is not to ask metaphysical questions, not to search for something which is different outside of your experience, but to start in your experience of what's happening right now by looking at where the discomfort is, where the suffering is. And as you look at that suffering, then explore it, get to know it in a wise way. Be wise about it. And when you're wise and explore it well enough, at some point, sooner or later, you'll see the drivenness, the compulsivity, the thirsting, or the clinging that's given rise to it. Once you see it well enough, what's given rise to it, and sometimes you have to see it for a long time, but really see it well, carefully, then you can maybe begin letting go of it or let go of itself. So the truth of the cessation, the truth of the path, the truth of suffering, and the truth of letting go of or the cause of suffering. Now the fourth noble truth, there's 8 different steps that the Buddha laid out. And I'm not going to go into them today, but those 8 steps are a recognition that it's not easy to do this work. It's easy to talk about it. It's easy sometimes in small, little, simplistic things in daily life. But to really do this well is not easy. And so we need a whole, you know, we need to kind of include a whole kind of holistic approach to making this possible, this kind of work. So the Buddha said it's important to look at our behavior and to live a life that is supportive of developing the deepest form of well-being human person can. So we look at our behavior. And then it's important to begin developing skills of looking carefully. Skills of mindfulness, so we can look well, and skills of concentration. So when we look with some ability to be still and concentrated and focused as we do that. If we're not focused, we're not going to see very well. So it might take a long time to develop and explore the Eightfold Path, these 8 steps, and to integrate them into our life so they become a really good support for being able to do this looking at suffering and letting go of the cause. The second of the Eightfold Path, and I'll end with this, is called right intention. So the first of this Eightfold Path is seeing the path. Seeing the path that's in suffering, the cause of suffering, and the release from suffering. Seeing that the path is just in that simple formulation. That's the first step. The second step is having seen that, is having the right attitude, or the healthy attitude, or intention in relationship to what you've seen. So the second path, second step of the Eightfold Path is right intention or right attitude. And this has to do with trying to find the attitudes that are attitudes which are helpful and not harmful. To avoid attitudes which are antagonistic to ourselves or situation, unkind, harmful, and try to cultivate intentions or attitude which are friendly, kind, non-harming, compassionate. And because it's very difficult to do this work at times of looking at suffering. And to do it in a wise way, you need to bring with you an attitude of acceptance, of compassion, of kindness towards yourself and the situation. Some people, maybe all of us at different times, need to spend a lot of time working at the second step of the Eightfold Path, developing the kindness, the compassion, the non-harming attitude about what's going on. Because to sometimes go directly into suffering and look at it is counterindicated. Because some people, it's almost like re-traumatizing to look at their suffering, look at where the difficulties are, and just kind of like putting salt on a wound. And so sometimes you don't want to have this direct approach, but you want to kind of work on the second step of the Eightfold Path for a while, so that when you do look at your suffering, you can and how you're causing the suffering through the clinging and grasping, that you can somehow do it with a lot of kindness and compassion and gentleness as you do that in a wise way. When he's taught about the Four Noble Truths, the monk Tanisara Bhikkhu has said that he uses an analogy that if you go to the plains of Africa to go photographing the animals, it's not so wise to go searching all over, wandering around looking for the animals to take a picture of. It's wiser to sit by the watering hole and wait, because all the animals sooner or later will come to the watering hole. And in the same way, the Four Noble Truths are the watering hole. If you sit by the Four Noble Truths, everything that you need to know for your spiritual life will come to you. If it doesn't come to you, you probably don't need to know it. So may you explore the Four Noble Truths for this year. And may it bring you and your neighbors and your society a lot of benefit from your explorations. May all beings be happy. Thank you.